This Hedgecoo series of podcasts is produced by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Hedgecoo. This is your Hedgecoo Master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland Magazine. Now, in our last podcast, we discussed Limerick in the revolutionary decade, and today we're going to hop across the River Shannon to the neighbouring Banner County. Despite its apparent geographical isolation, with the Atlantic to the west and north and the Shannon to the south and east, County Clare has been centre stage in Irish political life from the election of Daniel O'Connell in 1828 to the equally groundbreaking election of Éamon de Valera in 1917. And it was one of the most active counties in the War of Independence. So to discuss County Clare in the revolutionary decade, we're joined by Cecile Gordon, archivist with Military Archives, their military service pensions collection. Tomás Muchamara, author of The Time of the Tans, an oral history of the War of Independence in County Clare. A regular Hedgecoo participant, Tádhg Ógó Ruarc, author of Blood on the Banner, The Republican Struggle in Clare. And finally, Joe Power, author of Clare and the War of Independence. And this Hedgecoo is supported by Clare County Council and the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Community Strand of the Decade of Centenaries programme. Now, Tomás, if I can go to you first with the point I alluded to in my introduction. The geography of Clare, because it has a particular geography, just talk to us a little bit about that and the economy. You know, what type of society are we talking about here?
Yeah, thanks, Tommy. Look, I think it is really important to consider it because, you know, it has often been said the nature of Clare's geography creates an almost island-like experience, and that being cut off almost from the rest of the country created its own consciousness and sentiment. And that, you know, there's possible truth in that. Now, it would be important to say that certain sections of the population would be cut off as a result of that. I mean, there were, particularly in the 19th century, the main towns of Killaloe, Innistime, and Innis, and Kilrush, you know, would have had pathways to other counties. So the key people in those areas wouldn't have been as cut off as other people in the predominantly rural areas of County Clare. So in the situation where in the early 1900s, you know, 90% of people are living in rural areas, and almost all of those people would be living in areas which were, by the poor development of roads, cut off largely from, you know, neighbouring counties, etc. So for significant amounts of the population, there would be that sense of isolationism. But I think what's important in the context of how Clare develops across the 19th century is there is a growing sense of a political consciousness at a grassroots level. And, you know, it's important to look at that in the way in which support for, you know, republicanism manifests in the 1920s. We've seen multiple examples, obviously, throughout the land war, but even before that, when, for example, the Tipperary by-election of 1869, when O'Donovan Rossa was elected, you see fairly significant mobilization of celebration across County Clare. And again, in fairly big numbers, you're seeing that. Now, that's not really registerable at a political level, but it's really important for us as historians to take account of that and how that feeds in, again, as I say, into broader political support and feeling.
Tomás, what in terms of landholding, what size of landholdings are we talking about here? Or is it uniform across the whole county, or are there regional differences across the county?
Well, I mean, again, it's probably in terms of landholdings, it's similar to other counties in terms of the distribution from very large landholders through to the minute type of tenants that we would see. But what is important is after the famine, you see an increase in the number of larger landholders. Now, that's still a small number relative to the rest of the population, but it does increase the number of those large farmers in certain parts of the county. And of course, there's a difference and a distinction in terms of the different land from North Clare to East Clare, etc. But the same dynamic is there and the same frustration is there in different across the entire county. But I think it would be worth just briefly reflecting on the fact that in the land war and the period of, for example, you know, economic distress of 1879 to 82, you're seeing a reaction on the ground which you didn't see during the Great Hunger, for example, but you're seeing now in that period leading into the land war, evidence that people at a local level, irrespective of the size of their holding, are becoming conscious of the fact that, you know, the political landscape is affecting them directly, and that they can, through some form of mobilization, affect the political landscape. And that is true, you know, the violence that was akin to the Moonlighters of earlier generations, it's related to cultural mobilization, to even political mobilization. So that's one of the big kind of changes, I think, across the 19th century, is that when we get towards the end of it, for because of a variety of reasons, we see mobilization and a political consciousness developing at a ground level. Now, the way it manifests primarily is connected to land, but land is, in my view, inherently political. So when we move in then through the towards the revolutionary period, we're seeing people maybe shifting slightly from primarily something that's affecting their pocket or affecting their economic situation to political forms of activism. But it's all very much coming together and is all very much interrelated. So the experience right across, particularly the late 19th century in County Clare, the Blythe evictions, the Vandeleur evictions, you know, even prior to that in 1881, Tommy, in East Clare and Bedyke, there was a 50-year-old man, John Maloney, killed when an RIC constable hit him with a rifle butt into the head. And, you know, I know from that incident, you know, and there were shots exchanged with the police during that you know, period of 1881 in Bedyke, that had an effect on multiple families subsequent to that who went on to become very actively involved in the Republican movement, including the grandson of that man who was killed. And even from a tape that I got from the 1970s, it was quite explicit that, you know, his activism later was very much connected to what happened to his grandfather and his community in the 1880s. So we're seeing that gradual increase in political consciousness. We're seeing, you know, political mobilization coming together. And then it kind of starts to shift and transform into something more fundamentally or explicitly political. But as I said, we can't disconnect what happens, you know, throughout all of those decades to what happens in the revolutionary period.
Now, Joe, there's another side to this story, of course, because in the forefront of, you know, the front line of the maintenance law and order was the Royal Irish Constabulary, which was locally recruited. But I'm assuming there would also have been a tradition of recruitment into the British Army. This would be a Munster Fusiliers area, I presume. So how did that play out in during the First World War?
Good morning, Tommy, and everybody. Yeah, the First World War had a huge impact on County Clare. Yeah, we know that about 4,000 or more than 4,000 people volunteered to fight in the forces of County Clare. And no, again, many of them would have joined from overseas. There were Clare people in exile in America or England or New Zealand or Australia, as well as, of course, those in Clare and other parts of Ireland and Britain. But 4,000, and of that number, we know that maybe 700 got killed. And it was a huge recruitment drive in the early stages of it. And we know, of course, of the split in the volunteers between those who followed John Redmond and followed his call for join the English forces, wherever the battles were being fought, and the Irish volunteers led by Owen McNeill then, who decided they weren't going to fight and they were going to fight for Ireland in Ireland if any fighting was to be done. And so, but there was that split really affected the county and affected Ireland all over the place. Of course it did. But back in Clare, there was a huge campaign, especially in the first half of the war, up to 1916, a huge campaign for recruitment. And you had the two MPs, the two Home Rule MPs at the time, Irish Party MPs. You had Willie Redmond, brother of John Redmond. And you also had Arthur Lynch, who was famous for his role in the Boer War. Both of them were in favour of recruitment. You had the local newspapers also calling for recruitment, especially the Saturday Record and the Clare Journal. They were more Protestant supporters. The Clare Champion was a bit lukewarm on the subject.
But so just going back to the Irish volunteers and national volunteers, how did that split fall in Clare? I mean, it's usually a kind of a 10-to-1 split.
It's probably the same as nationally, probably about 10%. Maybe of the 3,000 or so volunteers in Clare that were probably recorded in, say, June 1914, about 300 of them, a core group, 300 to 400, would have split away, and they would not have served basically in the British forces.
Right.
And that was a small but very significant group of people, of men especially, who decided they were not, that was it. And they were to form the core of the volunteers and the core of the IRA afterwards in the War of Independence. It's from that small group that the War of Independence later developed.
Now, how many First World War recruits later became active in the IRA? Because this is a factor elsewhere, I think, Tom Barry in West Cork, most famously.
It's a good question. I've studied, I've looked over that, the records of the things there, and I'm aware of at least 20 men who actually had fought in World War One in either in the American Army or British forces, and who played a significant role in the local War of Independence in Clare. I can go through a list of a few types. You had Bill Hawke. He was in the US Marines. He was over from Shrea back near Kirosh. And he came back to fight in the War of Independence. And he was the adjutant of the West Clare Brigade. And he was very involved in the active service unit there. You also had, you wouldn't believe it, there was a Father Michael McKenna he was up in Mullock. Now, he had been in World War as a chaplain, but he turned up to be in Mullock. He came back and he became captain of the Mullock Company of the IRA, believe it or not. You had Joe Clancy, Kilkishan area. He took part in the Glenwood ambush over there and other places. Don't forget Joe Hawes from Tubber, who went on instigated the Connacht Ranger Mutiny over in India, for which he was sentenced to death. And he described himself as an IRA member. You had a few people. You had Ignatius O'Neill, who was the commandant of the 4th Battalion of the Mid-Clare Brigade. He fought in the Irish Guards, and he was very significant in the Renin ambush and other activities in the North Clare area. You had a few people also very much involved in the active service units around Ennis and Clare Castle. You had Paddy Conn McMahon from Ennis, very active in the active service areas there. Martin Slattery from Ballyhale, from Dara region. And you had a man, Tommy Kinnan from Clare Castle, also very much involved in the active group there as well. So again, there were many others as well, who probably less active, less prominent maybe, but I'm aware of these people that stood out in my estimation anyway, as people who did make a significant contribution to the war. But even there were some people like, was a man called Mulcahy from Ennis, and he had been in the signals area, and he worked in the post office, and he was very, very useful for passing on information and interpreting codes and RIC codes and stuff like that. And he passed them on to the IRA through Frank Barrett and the Mid-Clare Brigade. So you had people serving in different roles, in different areas, but as I say, either in leadership or semi-leadership areas. But to my opinion, those 20 people that I've found out there, and there may have been others, I've no doubt there probably are others that I'm not aware of, but they made a significant contribution to the war.
Porrick, I just want to go on to you, because the big event then in this period was the by-election of 1917, when Éamon de Valera was elected. Now, usually the rise of Sinn Féin is linked to the anti-conscription campaign, but I'm assuming this was before the conscription campaign developed a head of steam. So how can we account for it?
Well, conscription hadn't been passed for Ireland at that stage, but it was likely to. And it was one of the big, topics that came up, one of the big issues that was debated, not just in the East Clare by-election, but in the other by-elections.
So just to clarify, conscription was on the agenda in 1917.
It was on the agenda.
Yeah,
it was obvious.
That's okay.
So what happened is, obviously, 1917, a year after the Rising, there's an obvious, growth in support for republicanism. But Irish politics is still in flux at that stage. And you have a series of by-elections that come up in that year. Now, the first one is in Roscommon in February, and Sinn Féin win that by 2,000 votes. So this looks like a huge political swing. The next one is in Longford in May. Sinn Féin win it by just 37 votes. And then the third by-election that comes up that's rarely discussed is in Dublin in June. and that's by the Home Rule Party. It's won by them. And Sinn Féin don't even put up a candidate. So the argument that the political pundits are putting out is that Sinn Féin's rise is a flash in the pan after the rising. It's gone. And then suddenly Major Willie Redmond, who was a member of Parliament, brother of John Redmond, is killed in the First World War. The East Clare election comes up, and this is regarded as the acid test. If Sinn Féin are going to keep their momentum, they have to win this. Now, a guy called Lynch was selected as the Home Rule candidate. He was a very popular local barrister in Clare, and De Valera was selected as the Sinn Féin candidate. Now, De Valera was pretty much totally unknown in Clare at the time. In fact, people canvassing for him went out and used the slogan, "Vote for the man with the strange name," because a lot of them couldn't even pronounce it. And all that mattered about him, and all the people of Clare knew about him really, is that he was a veteran of the 1916 Rising.
All right, just to cut across you very quickly here, is Thomas Ashe dead or alive at this stage, or just in terms of the day?
Thomas Ashe I think Ashe is still...
He's alive.
He's alive at this stage.
The reason I mentioned that is that, see, Ashe would have had an equal prominence to Dev in terms of being a 1916 veteran and so on, you know, and there is a thought that if he had survived, he might have become the leader rather than De Valera.
Yeah, Ash's brother was actually teaching Irish in West Clare at the time, and his name was mentioned as a candidate. And in fact, as often happens in modern politics, the local Cumann in Clare wanted Padder Clancy, who was a very well-known Clare man, 1916 veteran, later killed on Bloody Sunday in 1920, of course. He was initially selected, but party headquarters had other ideas and wanted De Valera. But in the end, all that mattered was that the two big issues, as you mentioned, were conscription. But really, the second big issue was the by-election was run as a referendum on whether the people of Clare in Ireland wanted a republic or home rule. And in fact, another interesting thing about it is it's the first time the people of Clare had got to cast their votes in about 40 years, because prior to this, elections were uncontested. The parliamentary party just put up a candidate and no one would stand against them. And what happens during the by-election is the politics of it get very dirty, very nasty, very quickly. The Home Rule Party run what I would argue is essentially a racist and anti-Semitic campaign against De Valera. If you look at their speeches, the Home Rule Party hail Lynch and Redmond as, quote, thoroughbred Celts, patriots, and Christian Irishmen. And they denounce De Valera as, quote, a stranger, a foreigner, a half-breed. Now, that's the dog whistle to racism. But here is when it's put explicitly. On the walls in Killaloe was painted and whitewashed in big letters, De Valera the Jew, put the bastard down. And it very went from, you know, ugly language, it very quickly went from ugly language to political violence. And let's be honest, both sides, the Republicans and the Home Rulers, you know, used physical force, fighting. There was a lot of brawling between both sides. But it came to gunshots at one stage when De Valera and his supporters were travelling in cars to Broadford in East Clare, and they were actually found the road blocked and they were shot at in an ambush. There were several RIC baton charges breaking up largely peaceful Sinn Féin rallies. And after the election, the RIC actually shot dead in Kerry, John Scanlon, an unarmed IRA volunteer who was joining in the celebrations. And a lot of the violence against Republicans was orchestrated by the Hibernians. And they attacked, they would be a very right-wing conservative Catholic group. And they attacked, for example, Jewish Republicans who came down to Clare, like Michael Noyick, and they would have been, you know, anti-Semitic and would have criticised him for being Jewish. And Protestant Republicans who spoke for De Valera, like Daryl Fidges, were attacked and harangued as well. And in with the Hibernians as well, and just finish on a very quick quote from a guy, Canon Michael Hayes. He was the PP of Fecal, later a spy for the British during the War of Independence. And he said in an election rally, "I stand on the side of faith and fatherland for Lynch and Home Rule. Sinn Féin has a policy of socialism and anarchy which strikes at the very roots of Christianity. The church has warned us that Sinn Féin poses a great danger to our faith, and I urge you to rescue our religion and our country by returning De Valera, by returning Mr. Lynch, a Clare man, and not a foreigner like De Valera." And ultimately what happens is, of course, Sinn Féin win, and the new election, the new slogan which goes around Ireland is the Parliamentary Party, wounded in Roscommon, killed in Longford, buried in East Clare.
Yeah, Joe, actually, I was going to bring you, Joe, if you come in on the role of the church, right, which Pádraig has alluded to, because that shifted over time.
But just to add to what Padraig said there about the priests and the clergy, you know, there was a Father Slattery of Quinn also, a parish priest of Quinn, and he said if the people voted for De Valera, they would face red ruin and revolution. So they were seen as almost like a communistic as well at that point. But let's not forget that there was also other opposition to De Valera, and that came from separation women. And many of whom had might have been war widows or had relations fighting in World War over in the war, and they put up fierce opposition. And Michael Brennan and East Clare, you described them as viragos, and they were not in favor of De Valera because their men were fighting over in the trenches of the Western Front and other places. So they too put up a huge fight. But you know, it wasn't all one way. The church, there were several other people. There was a Father James Clancy. He was a parish priest of Kilballyone. Now, he was very much in favor of De Valera. And don't forget as well that De Valera also called upon the Bishop of Limerick as a courtesy just before the election, Dr. Eamon O'Dwyer, the famous Bishop of Limerick. And he got his blessing more or less just before the election. So in one sense, while some members of the church and others saw De Valera as a kind of a communist and as a foreigner, definitely, others were supportive of him. And but Bishop Fogarty didn't come out in favour.
Joe, just talk about in terms of where Clare, the diocese, because it's kind of complicated. I know Killaloe is one of the dioceses, but part of it is Galway as well. Is that correct?
That's correct.
It's in two dioceses.
About a quarter, a third of the county, maybe a quarter of the county in North Clare area, Innisdiamond, down to Lahinch, over to Listowel, all and Ballyvaughan and that region, is part of the diocese of Kilfenora, which was attached to Galway. And so therefore, there you had Bishop O'Dea of Galway. Now, he was a different caliber altogether, too. He was more conservative, much more so than the Bishop of Killaloe, Dr. Fogarty, who turned out to be quite Republican for in these years, during these times anyway, and certainly saw the De Valera as the
more... Joe, was he consistently so, or did he switch horses, you know, as the wind changed, as it were?
He began to change after the 1916 election, publicly at least, anyway. Right. You know, that point, he had written, he didn't admire, I suppose, the rebels in 1916. He called it brave but reckless and foolish, whatever. But nevertheless, he admired their sacrifice and he admired the fact that they were prepared to do that. And he also, certainly after the election of De Valera, he came out publicly in support of De Valera and Sinn Féin. Right. And from then on, in the 1918 election, he was a huge factor in that. He was also very significant in the anti-conscription crisis, which he led in the county and in the diocese. He was, and you know, he was a man that he made a famous. He wrote a letter one time. He said, "Sinn Féin arose and drove the English rust from the soul of Ireland." You know, this is a man that he was becoming much more Republican. He was probably, after Bishop O'Dwyer of Limerick, the most Republican bishop in the hierarchy at that time. And that continued for a few years up until the treaty, and then he changed. But that's
Moss. Did you want to come in on the Dev by election?
Yes. Well. More broadly, 1917, really, because I think what you're seeing, what's really really important in 1917 in terms of political mobilization, is it's now shifted from, you know, advanced separatism operating almost in the shadows prior to 1916 to now operating publicly. And for that to be seen by the public is really, really significant. And particularly, you know, as Padraig had said, Roscommon and Longford are really significant. But there are challenges to that. You know, as Padraig said, there's only 30 votes separating them in Longford, etc. And there's a sense that, OK, Joe McGuinness is only getting the votes because he's in jail, or Count Plunkett got them because his son had been executed. But when the East Clare by-election happened, you have a very definitive answer, but you also have a very public campaign, and you have women involved at a public level, you know, for the first time as well. I mean, they've been involved, you know, in political mobilization always, but really at a public level, you see coming among on the streets being involved. Many of them who wouldn't have the vote, even when in 1918 the franchise is secured. So that's really important. And there's a direct and deliberate a focus after that by the Clare Volunteers to maintain that public profile. And they put in a policy of drilling in front of the RIC after the East Clare by-election, which they knew they'd be arrested for. The next phase would be to refuse to recognise the court. And the third phase, when they were imprisoned, was to demand political status and, upon the denial of that, to hunger strike. Now, that was something initiated in County Clare And it was manifest in the Mountjoy hunger strike. Massash was in Clare for the East Clare by-election, stayed in North Clare, was up around the cliffs of Moher, etc., but very much was active in the campaign. But he dies 5 days into the hunger strike. For Clare, it's really significant, because 16 of the 38 hunger strikers are from County Clare. So they're seen then, you know, subsequent to the East Clare by-election, as advancing and pushing forward a very aggressive and open challenge to British authority. And that, in my view, when the Mountjoy hunger strike happens and Ash's death happens, becomes, in my view, in my opinion, the most significant moment since the Easter Rising, and maybe even more significant, because the death of Ash as a 31-year-old on hunger strike, which is unlike any other kind of death, has this sort of consolidative impact on political consciousness right across the country, where people now are beginning to support the idea of separatism openly and publicly, where they hadn't been even after the Easter Rising of 1916. So I think 1917 as a whole, and County Clare's role in that, is massively significant for what happens in the years that follow. And particularly moving into the centre of the conscription crisis, Clare is very advanced in its Republican sentiment than it might not have been had it not been for the East Clare by-election and for the death on hunger strike of Tomás Ash.
Now, Pádraig, I want to bring you in here, because this all comes to fruition with the 1918 general election, at the end of 1918. So what happens in Clare? We're talking about two constituencies, I presume. Is that right?
Yeah, I think you've East Clare and you've West Clare, basically, and Sinn Féin sweep the boards.
Are they really contested?
I don't think they're contested,
no.
Really.
Joe says no.
Yeah, the Home Rule Party has shot its bolt, and you get people like, obviously, De Valera is returned. I think one of the people who's returned is, and I'm just going from memory here, I haven't prepared this for the Hedge School, but you have De Valera, you also have, I think, Owen McNeill is returned as a candidate for Clare. You have Brian O'Higgins in West Clare, who would have been very big in the Gaelic League. And then the fourth one, I think, was Patrick Brennan, who would have been brother of Michael Brennan, the IRA leader, and Brennan himself was involved. So really, it's uncontested in Clare. You know, 1917 is the 1918 election in Clare. And what happened in Clare then is reflected in a lot of constituencies around the country.
Now, of course, that mandate is ignored by the British, and an armed struggle then develops over the following year. Cecile, I want to bring you in there. You've been waiting very patiently here. In terms of the War of Independence in Clare, like, how is that reflected in the files in the military service pension files, in terms of, you know, where is Clare in the league table of activity?
Clare is quite high up. I don't know about league table terminology, but it's quite high up in terms of activity in the country. Just to give you an idea, if I add up all the files, you know, between individuals, between the brigade activity files, between the nominal roles, I'm reaching some sort of figure like 4,000 files just for Clare. And I'm not counting those that are in the administration series. I know there's a couple there that are interesting. So for people who want to have a look at Clare during those years, these are the files you want to have a look at. First of all, the brigade in the membership series, you have the brigade activity reports. So these were returned in the mid-30s, outlining operations in each brigade areas, along with the names of those who took part. So we have three files there. They're big enough, complete with maps as well and sketches. A22, A23, A24, the East Clare, Mid Clare, and West Clare. When we processed those, we extracted 270 operations and all the locations associated with those operations for the county. So these are minor and more significant operations from locations from Bunratty to Tullycreen. These Bunratty Tullycreen is just the fork, if you want, of the locations. And we selected 12 highlights that were significant enough because there was enough documentations in the files, and we have a lot of individual files related to those operations, and we put those on the map. So it starts quite early with things like cattle drives in Castlefergus in 1918, shooting of two IRC members in Laverine in 1919, continues at different raids for arms, capture of IRC barracks, Newmarket on Fergus, And it goes down to the Civil War as well. And obviously in there, we have Renin and Bush and the attack on all British positions at Kilrush as well.
No, I just want to bring Pádraig in to help us out with this one, Pádraig, because you've a review in the current issue of History Ireland of the Dead of the Irish Revolution, edited by Eoin O'Halpin and Dobby O'Cronon. So what are the figures for Clare and the pro rata figures for Clare in terms of casualties, for example?
So per 100 or per 10,000 of population, Eoin O'Halpin and Dobby O'Cronon have Clare as the third highest county in terms of fatalities during the revolution. And they come just behind, so Clare there will come just behind County Cork, will be the highest number of fatalities per head of population, then Tipperary and then County Clare. Now, in an appendix to my book on Clare, Blood and the Banner, I listed out all of the IRA volunteers and members of Sinn Féin who were killed, all of the members of the Crown Forces, the RIC and the British Army who were killed, and all of the civilians I had. Now, obviously, O'Cronon and O'Halpin have turned up more fatalities that I didn't have. But off the top of my head, I think there were about 40 to 45 members of the British forces killed in Clare during the War of Independence. There were about 20 Republicans killed. Now, not all of those would have been members of the IRA. For example, there was one Fianna Éireann boy who was killed at the time, though the circumstances of his killing are disputed. You also had members of Sinn Féin, like Thomas Shannon, who were killed as well. And you had, I think, about 30 to 40 civilians who were killed. But again, if you go through the new book, The Dead of the Irish Revolution, you'll get details on all of them, and you can cross-reference that then with Joe's book, Tomás's book, and my own to get more local details.
Actually, Joe, I want to bring you in here because how are these figures reflected in the structures of the IRA? I'll tell you what I find interesting about this is that the volunteers, when established in 1913, were originally set up as a conventional army, as I understand it. Whereas the way the IRA developed during the War of Independence was a different sort of an animal, and there's a sort of a tension between the two. Would you go along with that?
Are you talking about the setting up of the structures in Clare?
Well, in general, was there a contradiction between the aspiration of the Irish Volunteers and the IRA as they became known to be a conventional army with a conventional army structure, yes, and the reality of flying columns and small units operating at local level?
Well, I suppose there was always going to be some tension between the control of the volunteers at local level from GHQ in Dublin. There was always that. The structures were made in Dublin, you might say, from the divisional structures were made for whether to have Keep Clare initially in 1916. It was associated with Limerick as one division. And then after, in 1917, they formed a separate Clare division. And until 1919. And then there was another structure reorganized again in 1919 up to 21, where there were three independent brigades. Now, the GHQ, they would appoint the chief men in each one. For instance, Michael Brennan in East Clare, you had Frank Barrett in Ennis, and over in West Clare, you had Art O'Donnell. But these structures, to a certain extent, there was a lot of autonomy at local level, and they didn't always obey the commands or the instructions of the HQ, and very often it was a long delay between HQ found out what happened at local level, and very often things happened that they were totally unaware of. And
now, how important were personalities here? Because these three men you mentioned, Barrett,
I think they were huge.
Give me the three guys again.
Yeah, they were hugely important. To a certain extent, at local, below the rank, the commandants, all the officers were generally elected on popularity basis at local level. And that was not always satisfactory, because very often you could get a person selected because he was the most popular. That didn't make that person the best officer,
right,
in any brigade or any division. And that was recorded in lead messages from GHQ down to Frank Barrett and others, that the selection of officers was crucial. But as well as that, there was little or no collaboration between, say, for instance, Frank Barrett and Michael Brennan of East Clare. Frank Barrett, a commandant of the Mid Clare Brigade, Michael Brennan of the East Clare Brigade, there was hardly, I don't think they really collaborated in any events whatsoever.
Did they not get on?
I don't think they personally, they didn't get on, as far to my knowledge. I've never
You have a theory on that, Parik. I've heard you mention this before. Tomás wants to come in on this. Tomás.
Well, yeah, just, I mean, I'm sure Patrick could probably say the same thing. But there was a huge tension between the Brennans and the Barretts. And I mean, Micheál and Frank would obviously be two principal figures in those families. But Paddy Brennan would have been more significant even in 1917, for example, in leading that campaign I mentioned earlier. But there definitely was a tension between both families. And that stems back even to 1916. There was an incident in the workhouse in Ennis of a meeting with the volunteers that Micheál Brennan took over the building, and Frank Barrett was the master was in charge of the workhouse. So there was a tension there, I would say, at a personal level. And I would say it developed then into, almost petty rivalry, because I think there's evidence in some cases where when the Mid Clare Brigade struck, you saw Brennan becoming more active. Now, there's a strategy in that, it's important for the IRA to draw attention of British forces across the county and across the country, as opposed to allowing it to concentrate in one area. But without a doubt, there is a tension in a manifest. Dick Mulcahy, I'm sure the lads have read it, complained a lot about the fact that the East Clare and Mid Clare Brigades, were kind of constantly at odds. But that's not unique, though. I mean, in Limerick, the brigades were often at odds, and again, it would be personalities. And, your point about that, Tommy, is important, because I think leadership is really critical. And Joe makes the point about officers and good officers, and that's really, really important. But in terms of activity, when you follow the trail around East Clare to a fairly big degree in terms of IRA actions, you'll see Micheál Brennan at the head of an awful lot of that. And in the same in Mid Clare, the likes of Ignatius O'Neill, people like that are at the forefront of leading activity there. So a strong leader and an active leader is really, really important in terms of how the War of Independence manifests in County Clare, and I'm sure right across the country. But just a brief point on your question earlier, Tommy, about the Irish Volunteers in terms of the military structure and the later development of the IRA. I don't think they're actually comparable, to be fair, because the Volunteers in 1913 were set up to reinforce home rule, or the prospect of home rule at that time. And that was based on what was the anticipated development of home rule in Ireland. That didn't develop. And then it entirely changed politically and militarily to a point where the IRA decided they had to fight for independence. And on that basis, fighting for independence with a conventional structure militarily would never have made sense. So it shifted entirely into the type of brigade structure that Joe outlined. And I think, I'm sure Joe and Padraig would agree with this, while there was autonomy, absolutely, and there was, actions taking place that the GHQ didn't have any awareness of, or maybe even didn't even agree with. I think, to be fair, when you assess it all, overall, discipline and structure was not that bad when you consider the challenges that were against the IRA, communication-wise, infrastructurally, all of that. I think it wasn't bad. And particularly look at the Collins papers, look at the Mulcahy papers, the attempts to maintain communication, to maintain reporting, and to maintain some sense of discipline wasn't bad overall. While of course there were breakdowns, there was ill discipline, and there was trouble in many cases.
Joe, just give us a quick comment, because I want to move on to the other side of the house in a second. Yeah.
Can I just add to that there about the structures? I mean, in Clare, for instance, there was a mutiny in Mid Clare which went on for months. And in late 1919 and into 1920, and it bedeviled the operations, Mid Clare, frustrated. It was a serious mutiny in the 2nd and 3rd and 4th battalion, 2nd and 3rd battalion areas. They just refused to accept orders, etc., and it had to be suppressed. Equally, I mean, when Cathal Brua formed a new Clare, 1st Western Division, he was Minister for Defence, and he tried to set it up in February 1921. But Frank Barrett and the other officers of Mid Clare just refused to cooperate. And in fact, they weren't able to set up this new division officially until November 1921. It's a long time afterwards. So there wasn't, Frank Barrett and others did not accept the orders of GHQ or even the Minister for Defence, Cathal Brua, when they were supposed to cooperate. Now, in fairness, the Westclare Brigade did cooperate with them, and that led, of course, to the famous cooperation between the Eastclare Brigade when Michael Brennan brought 25 volunteers over to Kilrush.
Joe, I'm going to come to that in a second, right? Hold that thought, will you? Because I'll be bringing Cecile in on that in a second. I just want to pivot the discussion in the other direction here, Padraig, and bring you in on this to look at Crown Forces, right? Now, frontline, of course, were the Royal Irish Constabulary, and they would have been the main victims of IRA activity. But there's another side to the story, Padraig, in that, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. Obviously, the British Army had a very large presence in places like in Ennis, and then during the War of Independence would have taken over often large country houses, the big houses, as we call them, big mansion houses, and would use them as barracks, and the RIC Auxiliary Division would as well. Pierce Beasley said in his biography of Michael Collins that it is in Clare that the guerrilla war can said have started. And when the War of Independence, the attacks by the IRA started in Clare, they were largely targeting the RIC. So the first time that the IRA actually attacked the Crown Forces is the attempted assassination of RIC Constable Johns and Ennistymon. That's in March of 1917, so well before Solihull Beg. The first barracks attack by the IRA is in January 1918, and that's against an RIC protection hut in Inch. And then in the 24th of February 1919, you actually had two RIC constables shot in what would have been the first ambush by the IRA. So if we talk about the role of the RIC, who were, I suppose, the main IRA's main enemy in Clare at the time, you would have had, it's important to remember, we talked about ex-First World War veterans joining the IRA. Joe mentioned that. You also had at least 69 ex-soldiers from Clare who joined the Black and Tans and the RIC auxiliaries. Again, mostly ex-soldiers, and some of them were actually stationed in Clare. But the record of the RIC in Clare, I would argue, is a very poor one during the War of Independence. One of the big things that happens is the Milltown Massacre, 14th of April 1920, a crowd in Milltown Malbay celebrating the release of hunger strikers from Mountjoy. And basically, RIC Sergeant Hampson brings down a mixed group of RIC and British soldiers, and they open fire, killing one IRA volunteer and two civilians. And that leads to a massive change in the public attitude to the RIC in Clare, and they're boycotted and people won't talk to them or serve them in shops afterwards. You then have incidents like Thomas Shannon, who's a Sinn Féin judge, who is assassinated by members of the RIC and Black and Tans, the Scariff Martyrs, four unarmed prisoners who were killed by RIC auxiliaries, and Sergeant Brennan and D.I. Gwynn of the regular RIC are involved. And I know Tomás may mention more on that later. The Limerick curfew murders, even the assassination of the mayor of Limerick and the ex-mayor Clancy O'Callaghan and IRA volunteer Joe Donoghue in March of 1921. The RIC murder gang that were involved in that, murder gang as they were called by the IRA, were actually led by George Nathan, who travelled there that evening from Killaloe, but also William Harrison, a member of G Division of the Auxiliaries based in Killaloe. And finally, I'd say the Blackwater Massacre, when you had an RIC patrol led by Sergeant Horne, 20th of February 1921. And in Parteen in Southeast Clare, they shot dead two innocent teenage brothers, Cecil and Aidan O'Donovan. And when the boycott of the government's planned RIC commemoration began, the mayor of Clare, Cathal Crowe, actually cited Blackwater as part of the reason he was initiating the boycott. And one very interesting thing in Clare to finish in this that happens that I don't think is as common in other counties is the number of RIC constables, not just who gave information because they were sympathetic to the IRA, but a number of them who actually defected and joined the IRA. William Bill Carroll was an RIC constable from Roscommon, stationed in Rouen Barracks, and he was actually the inside man who helped the IRA's Mid-Clare Brigade to capture that barracks. He joined the Mid-Clare Brigade Flying Column, fought in several ambushes, including Monreal, and then took the anti-treaty side in the Civil War. Thomas Healy, an RIC constable from Kerry, stationed in Ennis. He gave intelligence and ammunition to the IRA. He became suspected by the RIC, left the force, escaped from an RIC murder gang who called to his house, and then went on the run, joined the IRA, and was killed in action fighting with the IRA against the RIC in Six Mile Bridge. And finally, Patrick Buckley, an RIC constable from Kerry, stationed in Newmarket and Fergus. Again, he gets in contact with the East Clare Brigade of the IRA. He helped them capture the Newmarket and Fergus RIC barracks. And then during the Civil War, he takes the anti-treaty side and he's killed by the Free State Army in the famous, infamous Ballyseedy massacre.
Now, I want to move on to some of the major engagements of the War of Independence. Cecile, you did mention this earlier, the Ranin ambush in September 1920. What's in the files on that?
There's good documentation in the Midclare Brigade, that's A23 in the Brigade Activity Reports. It goes through the attack and who was involved. So it goes
Cecile, what happened at Ranin, roughly, just in broad terms?
It was an RA attack. People are more knowledgeable on this panel than me on this, but it was an RA attack on the lorry carrying a party of RRC members and Black and Tans as well. As far as I know, there were six RRC or Black and Tans killed, or killed on the spot, or who died later of their wounds. And this file contains some really good and detailed narratives of the event. There's a copy as well of John Joseph Nealon's article for the Cosentaur, 1941. And he relates that fight, the story of the Ranin ambush on three or four pages, complete with sketches as well. Nealon was in charge of the 4th Battalion. And I think he started in Kilfenora Company. And he later emigrated to the US. And right now we're able to have maybe between 20 and 25 individual files that are linked to this operation. But also we have a good documentation on the file about the reprisals that came after the ambush, and very good files as well that informs us on Patrick Lehane, who died, who was killed during the reprisals, through the applications of his mother Margaret Lehane and his sister Mary O'Neill.
Pori, can I bring you in on the question of reprisals? What sort of reprisals are we talking about in reaction to the Ranin ambush?
So as Cecile mentioned, you had this RIC patrol who were pretty much totally wiped out, all six members of it. And immediately afterwards, the Royal Scots Regiment from the British Army arrived, and they shot. They were enraged by what they found. The IRA flying column was just escaping as they arrived after the ambush, and the IRA managed to escape with just two or three wounded. And the Royal Scots immediately take out a local farmer, John Keane, who wasn't in the IRA, and they shot him dead with an illegal, what was found to be a dum-dum or expanding bullet, something the British, by the way, normally accused the IRA of, and breaking the Hague Convention and these things. But that killing started widespread reprisals right across the west of County Clare that night. And these reprisals took place 2 days after the sack of Balbriggan in Dublin. And they were much more extensive than Balbriggan, but because it was further from Dublin, they never got the same press coverage. You're talking about at least 70 properties being destroyed across four towns: Milltown Malbay, Liscannor, Lahinch, and Ennistymon. And seven people killed, one IRA volunteer and six civilians. And just one sentence on each of them: John Keane, the farmer we mentioned at the ambush site; Thomas Canol, who was a trade union organiser from Ennistymon, taken from his home, shot in front of his wife and two infant children, and then his house was set on fire and his body was thrown inside. PJ Lennan, 21-year-old from Ennistymon, he was putting out a fire at a neighbour's house when he was abducted by British soldiers and shot dead. Patrick Lehan, who was an IRA volunteer, he was hiding in Flanagan's shop in the Hinch when the building was set on fire, although, as Cecile will tell you, there's various other accounts in the pension files as to how he might have died. Dan Lehan, who was Patrick Lehan's father, who was shot in the throat by a British raiding party who came to his home. The sixth victim, Joseph Salmon, wasn't even from the area. He was on holiday, staying in a hotel, attacked by soldiers, and he was shot dead as he fled. And Nora Fox, a 12-year-old girl who suffered a fatal fall fleeing British soldiers who set fire to her home. Now, one interesting thing that comes up at the same time as Ranin as well is there's a sexual assault, an attempted gang rape of a woman called Kathleen Kelly, who lived at Knock in Kilrush. O'Kelly was assaulted, or there was an attempt at assaulting her by two men, a British soldier and an RIC constable named James Huddleston. Huddleston was a black and tanned from Leitrim. The soldier was acquitted, whereas Constable Huddleston was convicted, dismissed from the RIC and got 6 months with hard labour. And this is something that Professor Linda Connolly has talked about and has a new book out on women and sexual violence in the War of Independence. And things, incidents like that would have been very kind of hushed up, controversial, taboo at the time. But thankfully, historians like Linda Connolly are talking about that now. Yeah. And just that the blame for the Rinnean reprisals. Now, the RIC initially attempted to cover up the reprisals, blaming an anti-Sinn Féin gang, local loyalists. That was fictional. The Black and Tans were then blamed after Hammer Greenwood admitted in the House of Commons that there had been British involvement in these killings. But the people who were actually responsible were British soldiers from the Royal Scots Regiment. And the surviving paperwork in there, in the British archives, shows that it was Royal Scots troops acting under orders. But it was easier to blame the Black and Tans than the British soldiers actually involved.
Just on the question of violence against women, we did a head school on this with Linda Connolly. So listeners, if you scroll down through your list of either on Spotify or on the History Hour website, you'll come to a very, very interesting discussion we had, including with Linda Connolly. She was on the panel for that one. Tomás, I want to move on to another incident now. This is the Scariff Martyrs. Just first of all, just tell us, what are we talking about here? What happened in that particular instance? This is 16th of November, 1920.
Yeah, on the 16th of November 1920, Tommy, at about midnight, four young men were shot dead on the bridge of Killaloe. There were Martin Gilday, Michael Brod McMahon and Alfie Rogers, who were three active IRA volunteers in the Scariff Company.
But Tomás, was this a reprisal, or is this the Crown getting the retaliation in first?
I'm going to go back over what happened.
Okay, sorry,
months,
yeah.
But yeah, just to kind of put it in context, you had those three IRA volunteers and one civilian, Michael Egan. Michael Egan wasn't in the IRA at all. He was the caretaker of Williamstown House in Whitegate, further north into East there, where the other three lads had been staying for some weeks while they were on the run. And the reason they were on the run takes us back a few months, because on the 18th of September, just 4 days before the Rinnean ambush, the Scariff RIC barracks, which is the last most heavily fortified barracks in northeast Clare, was attacked. Now, that was a considerable attack. It brought companies from across the East Air Brigade, from Newmarket all the way up as far as Killinane, together. There was bombs brought down from Dublin, which ultimately proved ineffective. But it was a very significant attack. Two RIC men were shot and wounded, one black and tan and one RIC sergeant. They weren't killed, but they were wounded. Now, it was a really significant, as I say, attack. It lasted for 2 hours. There was an attempt to burn down the town hall in a reprisal after the attack the following day, and that was repelled by local IRA volunteers who mobilised again. But it was significant in the sense that Alfie Rogers and Michael Brod McMahon and Martin Gilday, who had managed to keep their activism under wraps up until that point, were now outed, and particularly McMahon and Rogers, who were the sons of local businessmen, were particularly singled out for blame by the RIC because of the fact that they had managed to maintain this kind of visage of innocence up until that. So they were on the run after that. There was a number of other significant events that followed. The 7th of October in Fecal, there was an ambush which led to the death of two RIC men, a sergeant and a constable. There was reprisals after that. There was no killings, but there was significant destruction and beatings in Fecal. That actually followed, my apologies, that followed two very significant attacks, one in Broughtford on the 25th of September, where Constable Brogan was shot dead. And on the 29th of September, two constables, Downey and O'Keefe, were shot dead on O'Brien's Bridge. So you had five RIC men killed, you know, between the attack in Scariff and the deaths of the Scariff Martyrs. You also had a civilian, Martin Coonahan, who was shot dead when he was shot on the basis of being a spy between Bodyke and Fecal, and managed to walk 2 miles where he eventually died in Bodyke.
So these were reprisals then?
Sorry?
They were, the Scariff killings were reprisals.
I don't think it can be seen as a reprisal in the way that others can. I mean, you can certainly see that there was a vengeance as part of it, but it didn't follow immediately after an action like the Rinnean ambush, for example, yeah, followed immediately by reprisals. But certainly there was an appetite for revenge amongst the British forces. The auxiliaries, G Company of the Auxiliaries, had arrived in late October. They about quelling the Republican movement in the area. They were given information, obviously, by a spy, which led them down on a boat, the SS Shannon, to capture the three IRA volunteers in Williamstown. There were attempts, and I have to mention this, I have a book coming out in September on all this, but there were attempts, you know, it's like Joe and Patrick have said, there were attempts by members of the auxiliaries even and the RIC to get information to the IRA about this. So there were people within those forces who were willing to try and support it. But ultimately, they were captured. They were brought up to Killaloe, and they were tortured and beaten for approximately 8 hours until they were taken out to the village of Killaloe. Now, the official recording was that they were shot trying to escape. That was challenged right from the start, even by the press, who found it difficult to believe that, you know, you would be taking prisoners across a bridge in the middle of the night and that they would try and escape in those kind of circumstances. But it was a really significant moment. Three IRA volunteers killed in one go. Obviously, four young men killed in very, very brutal circumstances. But it had a big impact on the landmark in East Clare, on the landscape in East Clare, and was without a doubt one of the biggest events in East Clare during that time.
Cecile, can I go to you now? I want to move on to the Kilrush operation, 22nd of April, 1921, because this was a combined brigade operation. And Joe, you can come in this as well. But Cecile, just what sort of stuff is in the files on this one?
There's good stuff as well in the West Clare Brigade activity files. So I think someone mentioned that it was the East Clare Brigade's flying column under Michael Brennan, who that joined the West Clare Brigade with Sean Liddy to carry out a combined attack on all enemy positions in Kilrush. And in the file, they do talk about the three main positions at stake: the workhouse buildings, the Coast Guard station, and the RIC barracks with other buildings around that. So there is a very clear description of the operation and how the development of it and the positions that the Republicans occupied, the plan of attack and the outcome, along with the names of those involved.
How many people were involved in this attack? Many IRA people?
That's hard to say, but I have the names of at least 13 people plus...
Joe, can you help us out there?
Well, there were at least 25 from the East Clare Brigade, and yes, there was 10 or 12 from the West Clare Brigade. So you would have 37 or thereabouts.
And with this, Joe, would you consider this to have been a successful operation?
Yes, it was.
Because whose initiative was it, given that this was a combined operation, which apparently goes against what you were all saying earlier about the lack of cooperation?
This was the first combined operation of the three brigades in Clare. And it was, they hit at the heart of the West military's Crown Force structure in West Clare, Kilrush. They hit at the heartland, and they killed one policeman, Sergeant McFadden. But they also wounded a few other people as well. And it was a very successful and caused a major shock to the British forces.
Whose initiative was it, though, Joe? Did this come from the top, or was it a local operation?
I think that, you know, that, say, Michael Brennan was instructed by GHQ, for instance, to go to East Galway as well. And I would imagine this is because of the new brigade structure I told you about earlier. And
Joe, that would seem to suggest then that you know, again, we're speculating here, if the war had gone on, that the IRA were well capable of these larger operations, properly planned.
Yes, it would have been, yes. Yeah. Well, depending on a number of factors, such as ammunition and things like
that. Sure. Tomás, do you want to come in on that?
Well, just an interesting point. And again, you always need to look at the periphery of a lot of these incidents. Patrick Riley, who was shot as a spy in Newmarket and Fergus, you know, that's bound up in that, because when Micheál Brennan leaves the area around Rainanna to move down further into West Clare, he leaves a note to the Newmarket IRA to deal with Patrick Riley. So that's on the fringes of it. What's really interesting in terms of drawing East Clare to West Clare is that when the reprisals happened in Feakle, the man who led the RAC in Black and Tans around Feakle to the burning of houses was Sergeant John McFadden. Well, he was Constable John McFadden at the time. He was subsequently moved out of Feakle because he was in danger from the IRA locally. And it was Sergeant John McFadden that was shot dead by Micheál Brennan that night in Kilrush Town. So it drew an interesting connection between, again, the local and the intimate nature of the war is very significant. It may also have been just coincidence that it happened to be McFadden that they met that night in Kilrush, but it certainly was noteworthy that he ended up being the one that was shot by the East Clare IRA, who he had left Feakle to try and get away from. But it is, I think you're right about the ability to cooperate. It is worth noting that it's the West Clare IRA that Brennan cooperates, not the Mid Clare IRA. which again, maybe it reinforces the kind of tensions that were there between mid and East Air Brigade leaders.
Now, I want, Borig, sorry, Joe, I want to move on because I'm keeping an eye on the time here, and I want to move on to the very controversial question of spies and informers. Now, Borig, one of the things, you did an article on this a while back in History Ireland, and one of the things that struck me was only 3 civilians were killed as spies by the IRA, but of course, people who weren't civilians were also killed, and this is tiny compared to, say, County Cork. But what I want to get on to is the killing of Patrick Darcy, because this is a particular and unique situation. Could you give us the basic facts of the case here? Like, who was Patrick Darcy? What were the circumstances of his killing?
Well, Patrick Darcy was a local school teacher. He was 27 years old. He was a school teacher from Dunbeg. He was unmarried and he was also an IRA volunteer. Now, the Darcy family would have been quite Republican. He had 2 other brothers who were in the IRA as well. I think one of his brothers was killed after an IRA ambush when you had the group of IRA volunteers fleeing after an unsuccessful attempt at an ambush in the RIC, and one of Darcy's brothers fell into the river and was drowned. And that basically caused a lot of bad blood between the Darcy family and the leadership of the local IRA unit. And Darcy's other brother, who was involved in the IRA, was stationed in Ennis, so he was a bit away from this. Now, it was obvious that there was a spy or spies active in Clare. The Darcy family, as well as having a bone to pick with the local IRA leadership, as they saw it, Patrick Darcy, or Pa Darcy as he was known, seems to have started drinking quite heavily. He was drinking in a pub called Sheehan's, which was a place where the black and tans would frequent quite a lot. And in 1920, he was effectively, his IRA membership ceased, and locals became suspicious that he may have been actually been spying for the British. Now, ultimately, he was executed, I think, in June of 1921. And I think it's fair to say it is probably one of the most controversial and the most investigated of any killings of alleged spies in the War of Independence.
Can I just stop you there, because we'll just continue the discussion, but I want to go to Cecile, because in terms of evidence and what's in the pension files on this one, I'm assuming there's a fat file on this guy's demise.
It's a very, very fat file, and it's a metal file. Usually metal files are about either between an empty cover and 40 to 50 pages. This one is divided into 2 folders, and it's around 400 pages all in all. Wow,
that's a lot.
That's massive.
And all around the killing of this.
Archivists, Robert McEvoy spent weeks on this one.
But I mean, this is all in connection with one killing. Am I right?
Yes and no. It starts with the application from the mother for a posthumous medal. And basically, to get a medal, all you need to prove is 3 months membership with the IRA in this case. But that question prompts a whole lot, right, of evidence gathering and collecting, including what Colonel Bryan does. As far as I know, there had been previous investigations prior to 45, 46. But the file, it's impossible to list all the elements on the file.
Cecile, this is a difficult question, but is there any conclusion to this fat file? Is anyone going to say X, Y, and Z happened, right, and this guy's exonerated or not, as the case may be?
He's not exonerated, but because it's a medal application, for us, the bottom line is it's unsuccessful because they were unable to prove that at that time he had 3 months, of continuous.
But of course, the point is, he could have 3 months continuous service in the IRA and be a spy, right? There's no contradiction
But if you go into the file, every statement is contradicted. Every affidavit is contradicted by another one. I have here like a copy of a letter of Daniel Sheedy, who was a battalion commandant for West Clare Brigade. And it's in what Parek said about the fact that they were drinking. He says, "Personally, I was very friendly with Pa Pierre, Patrick. But being a teetotaler myself at the time, I considered he was too fond of the drink to be reliable for information work that he was supposed to be doing. There's little things like that, and some pretty, how do you say, shady sayings, you know, with Sean Liddy as well. The file is, I mean, it's a movie. It's it really would deserve more time on it. Robert McEvoy, one of our archivists, wrote a very good blog post on the file on our blog on WordPress. And beyond that medal file, obviously we have the application for service pensions for Sean Liddy as well. Stephen Anrahan, Michael Russell, Liam Hogg, and then application in respect of Michael Darcy, who's the brother, he was drowned, Michael McNamara, who were the two, the two our members with whom we all started. The second part of the file is long sworn evidence given before the referee and advisory committee by people like Sean Liddy, Margaret Daly, John Daly, her husband, John Darcy, Patrick Shanahan, Major Conor Whelan, Comlan Martin, Comlan Marinan, Comlan Linghawk, Comlan Joseph Barrett, Martin Chambers. It goes on and on and on and on. So if you want a fat file for your weekend, this is the one.
Okay, tell you, Joe, a quick comment for you, and then I'll go to Parik.
Just one or two points there. In Michael Russell's witness statement, he refers to the court martial interview of Patrick Darcy. And so that would suggest that he was a member of the IRA at the time. And second point, much credence has been placed on the evidence or the testimony of Dennis Sheehan, who framed him. Dennis Sheehan was an ex-RIC man who was from Dunbeg, who married, I think he was from Cork, but he married a woman from Dunbeg. And he was even prepared, when he was being interrogated by the IRA, he was even prepared to blame it on his wife, that he said she might have leaked information. Yes. and as well as that, you know, so bear that in mind. And by the way, Patrick Darcy was in Coora Clare, not Dunbeg. He worked as a national teacher in Dunbeg. He's from Coora Clare. And he would have known Sean Liddy, the commander. The families were very close. The West Clare Brigade commandant, Sean Liddy, was very close to the Daly family. So that is more controversial as well. But and then his last reputed words were, you know, again, according to, if you believe the evidence of Michael Russell, he says, "I forgive you, boys. You're shooting me in the wrong." Now, Judge Sean Enright has written a recent book about executions in the Civil War, and he said any statement given by a person about to die was always accepted as being credible in court, and a certain amount of credence in that. And, when a person says, "You're shooting me in the wrong, I forgive you, boys." Now, it's a Christian thing to forgive, obviously. He's a Catholic and he's about to die. But nevertheless, I think there must be some truth in that. I actually believe that he was innocent. I think he was framed by Dennis Sheehan. And he perhaps, as others suggested, Sheehan and Darcy could have been interrogated together. They weren't, apparently. And that was the end of that. And the trial was over and the execution was carried out very quickly afterwards. And there was no appeal. And
Parik, do you want to come in on that, Parik?
Yeah, just to say that, to give an overall view on it, Darcy is one of only four IRA volunteers shot as an alleged spy out of nearly 200 people executed as spies by the IRA. You have local family and political factions. Generally, if you look at the file Cecile is talking about, pro-treaty veterans tend to say Darcy was guilty, and anti-treaty veterans tend to say Darcy was innocent. And there is another case similar to it in Limerick, where James Dalton, an IRA intelligence officer, was shot dead as a spy. And in that case, Dáil Éireann and the IRA had no problem coming out saying that he was shot in the wrong and issuing a posthumous pardon. Now, Darcy never got that. There were two inquiries launched into the shooting. One of them was by Owen O'Duffy in 1921. And the second one was by Colonel Dan Bryan, head of G2 Irish Army Intelligence, in 1945-46. And the Darcy family had a lot of political influence, and neither of the findings of those inquiries were ever published. The family applied for a medal. I think that was really to try and get another way to, pardon him posthumously, and that was rejected. And finally, the British accepted full liability for his death and paid a substantial amount of compensation, which the family accepted. And we can't find out for certain. The British won't share their files on who was and who wasn't involved. In fact, Barry Keane, a Cork historian, took the British Home Office to court a few years ago. And Darcy is one of the people who, as I said, is listed by the British as being their full responsibility, even though he's shot by the IRA. You do have a later statement saying from guys in the British Army saying, oh, Darcy never gave us information, but it was the RIC that the information was supposed to be being given to, not British soldiers. And really, if you're talking about raids and things that Darcy was accused of being involved in, the people who would have been leading those raids were RIC and their intelligence officers, not British soldiers. But I think the fact that it has been investigated at least twice formally and the medal application, and he was never exonerated like James Dalton in Limerick was, I think that says a lot.
Yeah. Okay, I tell you, that one's going to run and run. You just read another question, by the way, Fordic, which has come up previously in Head Schools, and there's a letter to the editor, it will be in the next issue of History Ireland. This is the, because we've heaped praise on Cecile and the Irish Military Archives for the marvellous military pensions collection. Unfortunately, British institutions are not as forthcoming, and it's very clear to me anyway that there must be tons of stuff still hidden away, buried in British archives. Cecile, do you want to come in on that?
Well, but the British Archives really, actually we were very lucky for, with Manchester Archives, for instance, to ask about, let's say, you know, the other side of Mrs. Lindsay murder, for instance, you know, and we were able to complete stuff thanks to them and have the other side of the story. So it can happen, sometimes it doesn't.
Okay, so you will get some patchy cooperation, if you like, from some institutions.
You could, I suppose, institutional cooperation is easier than just individual asking for.
No, I'm thinking more of the National Archives in Kew, but that's another discussion outside our jurisdiction. Tomás, you want to come in on that?
Very briefly, just to make the point, I think in relation to informers or informing, I think, you know, there was an awful lot more people involved in it than we might like to accept.
Because all the good ones would never have been discovered, right? That's the point about informers. The more effective ones are the ones you never realise, you know, you have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, in the case of the Scariff Martyrs, I mean, it's one of the burning questions, who was the spy? And I've been able to determine that it's not about who, it's which one, because there are 16 at least that I've been able to identify who were giving information in East Clare to the British, at least. But in the case, I think Joe's point, I think Sheehan has always been sketchy enough for me, but I think it's also possible that Darcy was giving information in addition to Sheehan, you know. So I think it's a reality that there was an awful lot of people doing it for a variety of different reasons. And I probably err with Padraig on the sense that I think ultimately I think Darcy may have been guilty of informing. Whether or not he was the one who was responsible for Mac and Shanahan is a different scenario. And I think certainly Sheehan is very, very dodgy when you look at what his contribution.
Well, I'll tell you, going back to Cecile's comment, right, there's definitely a film script in this one for somebody out there. Listen, guys, I'm looking at the clock here. We're going to have to wrap up. Joe, can I go to you? Because we have concentrated on the military campaign, and why not? Because it's so active in Clare, right? Just to sum up, like, what would your assessment of the IRA's campaign in Clare be? I mean, how effective was it, in your opinion?
It was very effective. Considering the total disparity between the forces, considering the fact that the IRA had very, very few weapons and relatively very few men. I mean, people involved in the active service groups, I mean, they would have been maybe 25, 30 men in each brigade. Maybe 100, 150 men, mainly men, but also women, of course, involved as an auxiliary supportive role. They took on the Crown forces, totaling up to 500 or 600 or more in the county, who were heavily armed. And they undermined British rule in the county. They literally paralysed the legal system in the county, setting up Sinn Féin courts and boycotting the other courts.
And we didn't go into that. I just say, Joe, like that's something we didn't go into in this discussion, but we have in previous head schools, the whole counter-state, you know, but go on.
Yes, they undermined the county finances. They took over stole the rate books from the county councils and gathered the money themselves. They totally paralyzed the road transport network by blowing up bridges and digging trenches in roads, etc., as well as the railway network. And telecommunications were also seriously hampered. basically speaking, the IRA controlled the countryside. The Crown forces still controlled the large towns. And effectively, the IRA, there was a stalemate. The IRA were not beaten, and neither could they beat the Crown forces. The forces were totally disparate. There's no way that they could have beaten in an engagement, the British Army, whatever. Not in a formal battle anyway. But certainly, there was a psychological warfare. I think the IRA won that as well, and the propaganda thing. There's no doubt about it. There was a stalemate here, and I think the stalemate was a fair result in the sense that the Crown forces were not beaten. They were forced into the towns, concentrated in the towns, but they were still very strong in the county, still very strong in Ennis, still strong in Kirosh, Ennis Diamond, whatever, Killaloe. But outside of that, in the smaller towns and the rural areas, you could say the IRA were in control. And really, undermined. British rule in County Clare was, I would say, totally undermined by the IRA campaign.
Tomás, can I go to you for the final word on this in terms of the memory of that period? Because you've done a lot of work on oral history and so on. So how has what Joe has been saying, how has that been reflected on how this is remembered today?
Yeah, I think it reflects exactly what Joe was saying there, and particularly in the sense that the war is very, very different to any other type of kind of war that the county might have known of, because it's happening in their townlands, it's happening in their villages and in their streets. So in the sense then that people of later generations have something very real and tangible to connect with. So the ambush, the event, the character, whatever it might be, can connect to their own local landscape. So it's a very relatable memory, and there's a lot of pride in the way in which the military structure was set up in accordance with the existing cultural and geographic boundaries, creates that sense of identity as well. So there's no question in my mind, obviously, as I say, I've been doing that for a long, long time, that there is a very rich memory. There's also a very valuable memory because, some of the nuances of the experience of the War of Independence are only really detectable when you get down to the ground level and you can actually compile that sense of the actual experience. The broader conventional sources, and I'm sure Cecile will agree with this, are really, really critical in building up a picture. But it's only when they're matched with the local experience, and so far as we can assemble that local experience, that you get a true sense of it. But certainly, Joe's point about the British infrastructure at its broadest understanding was completely undermined. I mean, in Clare, it was the first special military area declared in Ireland, and that was in February 1918. So, you had already a sense of alienation amongst the people from British authority, and that only deepened as you move through the War of Independence. So certainly there's a very rich history and memory that is very much alive and well.
Cecile, do you want to respond to Tomás on that?
Yeah, I really like that, because it talks about the sense of local identity and the flavor and things like that. And there are so many things happening away from military operations and military structure and all of that. And some fires are really being overlooked. We try to put some focus on the role of women, but the fires about lodged by women, either for their own service or as dependents of deceased veterans, are really, really, really good, because they give so much more flavor to the locality. They name everyone. They're so closely associated to the ASUs as well, and you get a ton of details on who goes through the house. So for each operations, we try to link, if you go on the Military Archives website on the Brigade Activity Reports, we try to link all the individual files to each operations. And generally speaking, the files pertaining to women give a lot of details about prior, where the men eat prior to the operation, where do they go after, who's there, who's captured, who's keeping who. And beyond the brigade activity reports that relates just about all the operations countrywide, you have to look at family clusters. Like we talked very quickly about the Brennans, we have Austin, Michael, and Patrick. We have the Barretts, and the Barretts are Joseph, Frank, Bridget, Delia, Bridget, Margaret, Josephine, Una Patterson. They're all linked, and the files are excellent. So I really encourage people to look at, family names and put them together and get a better picture, maybe that completes, the military aspects of the period.
Well, we like it at the Hedge School here when there's homework given out to our listeners there. So Cecilia has given plenty. Another one, Guy, for listeners to check out is the Hedge School we did in September 2019, but more or less the same panel. Joe Power wasn't on the panel, but he did speak very eloquently from the floor. It's a totally different discussion, by the way, because it concentrated quite a bit on the work of the late David Fitzpatrick, and in particular his 1977 Politics and Irish Life. But Cecile talked in great detail in that Hedge School as well about the military services pension collection in more detail. So we should check that out, listeners. But listen, we've run out of time on this one. I'd just like to thank our panel, Cecile Gordon, Tomás Macanmarla, Padraig O'Rourke, and Joe Power. And our next Hedge School will be on the Crossbarry engagement. The biggest engagement of the War of Independence, 19th of March 1921. So I hope you'll all tune in for that. Thank you very much.